Okay, here we go. Stand by.
3, 2, 1.
The Thinking Atheist. It's not a person. It's a symbol. An idea.
The population of atheists in this country is going through the roof.
Rejecting faith. Pursuing knowledge. Challenging the sacred.
If I tell the truth, it's because I tell the truth. Not because I put my hand on a book and made a wish.
And working together for a more rational world.
Take the risk of thinking for yourself. Much more happiness, truth, beauty, and wisdom will come to you that way.
Assume nothing. Question everything. And start thinking. This is the Thinking Atheist Podcast, hosted by Seth Andrews.
By the way, I've been doing these greets and shout outs on Cameo. And if somebody says, hey, my wife has a birthday, or my husband has a birthday, or it's our anniversary, special occasion, somebody graduated from college, or maybe they're just having a lousy day and need a pick me up, you know? So they will nominate those people, and I do a video greeting, and I'm able to do these from my phone. It is awesome. It is just so much fun to do. And, you know, it's cheap. It helps me to support my work for a few bucks. But mostly, it's been a great way to connect with the community and just share a smile. So if you know somebody, maybe it's the Valentine's Day holiday or something else coming up, and you'd like me to send them a message, just go to cameo.com and then search my name, Seth Andrews, and you can do it all right there online. Anyway, this is round two of our Bad Apologetics broadcast. I have put the link for last week's show in the description box in case you missed it. We covered a ton of stuff, everything from prove God does not exist to evolution is just a theory. It's not a religion, it's a relationship. You took it out of context. Look at the trees, or look at all this intelligent design of the beauty, the argument from beauty, whatever. It's all in there. We had Mandisa Thomas, Godless Engineer, Paula Gia, Aaron Raw, Cy Babe, and others join us. And today, we have another great lineup. I've got Thomas and Andrew from the Opening Arguments broadcast. I've got Matt Dillahunty, Margaret Downey, Mohammed Syed from Ex-Muslims of North America, Tracy Harris, Hemet Mehta from Friendly Atheist. And right now, let's kick it off with Shannon Q. She is a Canadian YouTuber and a friend. She talks a lot about religion, mental health, and psychology. And I figured she'd be a great way to kick off the show. Shannon Q, hi, how you doing?
Hi, Seth. I'm good. How are you?
I'm going through my long laundry list of apologetics arguments. I know you've got some keepers, right? Something at or near the top of your list. What is it?
My least favorite is what I like to call, yeah, but you haven't read this book yet.
So you need another book to explain the book.
Exactly. So one of the reasons that I dislike it so much is, A, it's pretentious. It's essentially saying, well, if you knew as much as me, you would think like I think. But my secondary problem with it is that when somebody approaches you with that, it's essentially saying, it's undermining their own argument, because I'm saying, I've read this religious text, and after reading this religious text, I can't buy into it. You know, I have problems with it. And they're saying, yes, but you need the supplemental text. You need the supplemental text as well. That book on its own isn't good enough. You need to read more books. Like, I had somebody talk to me recently, actually. I can't remember how long ago it was or who it was, and I don't want to call them out anyway. But I was going over arguments for the soul, and, you know, with things that I had found in the Christian Bible and where I didn't feel like it comported with my understanding of neuroscience. And they said, yeah, but you haven't read Plantinga. And to me, what I'm hearing is everybody up until this point in history has had an excuse to think like I think, right up until the point that Alvin Plantinga was born. I'm sorry, there's a small cat behind me having an absolute nervous breakdown because she
And
I don't know if you can hear the scurrying.
It's like that internet meme that shows what you have to do with cats during a Zoom call. You have to duct tape them to the wall just so you can have a Zoom meeting kind of thing. But you're saying, all right, so until the book came along to explain the book, everybody who existed pre-book was pretty much screwed, right?
Yeah, Exactly. So it's like they read Romans 1:20, and when it said, you know, you're without excuse. But that really meant, when God inspired the hand of the person who wrote that, was, well, you'll be without excuse in 19 whatever, when this book is finally published. But between now and then, you have an excuse. So why do you need the supplementary text? That's the thing that's always bothered me. Like, if your book at face value can't be taken and understood, if you need a laundry list and centuries worth of interpretation by people who aren't you in order to adopt a sufficient understanding to hold the belief, then it's like a tacit admission that the book itself isn't enough. And you would think that that's undermining your faith system.
Why would explanations be required from the same species who have screwed up everything else on the planet? God needed to save us because we are mere insects. We have no rudder, no center. We're aimless. We're flying around like gnats, crashing into walls, etc. By the way, I will now entrust them to spread my word or explain what I tried to mean in the first place. And the other frustration I have with that, yeah. Shannon, is like, you and I are over coffee, right? We're sitting down talking, and you're the apologist. And you say, well, you know, there's a great book about this, Seth, that you should read. It's only 500 pages. What that does is it actually sort of stops the conversation in that moment, because it would require me then to stop whatever I'm doing and go dive into this deep text and then come back. And I'm not saying that we don't do the research whenever possible, but to me, it seems like a bit of a cheat.
Right. Absolutely. I completely agree. And it's not a standard that they hold for their in-group either. So like, if somebody comes up to them and says, you know, I'm a Christian, they don't say, yeah, but are you really a Christian? Because have you read Plantinga? Did you read Swinburne? Like, are you sure that you know enough to hold that belief? Like, if I need to have a library card punched daily with an apologetics book in order to justify the position of not believing the same things you do, why shouldn't you have the same standard for the people that do believe the things you do? You seem to let those slide. But when I'm having a conversation with you, I need to submit a resume with an appropriate book list in order to be even considered as somebody you can take seriously in that conversation. It seems utterly ridiculous to me. And like you said, they utilize it to stop the conversation. They say, well, if you had read this book, then you would understand where I'm coming from. Okay, that's great. So you read that book and understand it. Fine. You and I are in this conversation. If you're not able to articulate to me your understanding of that book, then it's not us having a conversation. If I wanted to read the book, I'd just read the book. I'm talking to you.
One of the things I've noticed about your particular online feed is that you're not often fielding apologetics. You're fielding insults. Like, one of the ways people come after you is they come after, what, your gender, your face. I mean, it is like junior high. And you then have been changing your online Twitter handle, incorporating some of those insults into your actual public persona. Give me some of the gems as of late.
Oh, okay. My favorite one most recently was, I don't need to listen to you because you're some green-haired Antifa-looking bitch. That was my favorite one. I love that one so
much. That's some Christian love right there. Christian, what would Jesus say right there, you know?
Right now, my Twitter handle is, I think it's annoying and, let me look actually. What's my current Twitter handle? I've gone through so many, annoying and unwise.
You're annoying.
Annoying and unwise. Yeah. Sucks some of the power out of it for them, I think, because they realize that they're not actually, like, if I'm not taking that as a hit, I'm not going, oh, golly gee, this person said bad things about me and now I need to reassess what kind of person I am. I take that power and I give it to myself and I utilize it to perpetuate how foolish these types of interactions are by just making it my Twitter handle.
Well, often too. Again, I'm not talking about when we are roasting the sacred cows out there, or I think mockery has usefulness whenever you find people who are genuinely awful people who are doing destructive things and they take themselves way seriously. I think one of the weapons we have is to be able to knock them down a few notches, you know. But when you're in an actual discussion about truth claims with an interlocutor, I think in those moments when somebody resorts to the ad hom, it's a pretty good indication that they're on shaky ground. If you and I are talking about, well, is this true? Is this sustainable? And my response is, oh, yeah, you're ugly.
Yeah, but that, your face is stupid. Have you thought of it like that?
Yeah, you're a poopy head. You know, that's kind of an indicator that we may have some problems when it comes to reasoning. Shannon Q, thanks for being a part of this conversation. We will be watching your stream to see what new fresh handles are posted online. And you be safe out there, okay, my friend?
Thank you. Thank you. You as well, Seth.
I'm Hemant Mehta from FriendlyAtheist.com and the Friendly Atheist YouTube channel. And if we're talking about bad apologetic arguments that bug the heck out of me, I think one that doesn't always get enough attention, especially when atheists debunk them, is when people tell you if you want proof of God, you have to take a leap of faith. If you're willing to believe, God will make himself known to you. The main reason I don't like that argument is really a numerical one. It suggests you only have to take one leap. But religion isn't a long jump. It's a never-ending set of hurdles. There isn't one leap of faith. There are countless leaps you would have to make. No one should have to jump that much. Consider all the assumptions you have to make to believe in God. You have to believe there is a supernatural realm in our universe, and that there are beings in that supernatural realm, and that they have consciousness, and that at least one of those beings is eternal, and that this being can create the universe, and that this being can mess with the universe afterwards through miracles and natural disasters, and that this being is all-knowing, all-powerful, and all-loving, and that this being really has strong opinions about you touching yourself. None of those things make any sense. And yet people who want you to believe in their God want you to accept all of those things. Or maybe a lot more, depending on what kind of God they believe in. The details may vary, but the concept is the same. And all of that happens before we even get into the specifics of their faith, like the true nature of communion wafers. Don't let anyone get away with saying you need a leap of faith. It's never singular. It is always plural. And each leap is illogical.
Thanks to Hemant for being a part of the broadcast. You can follow Hemant Mehta's work at FriendlyAtheist.com. As he was talking, I was reminded of many conversations I have with apologists, and they kind of talk out of both sides of their mouth. So in one breath, it is, well, God is mysterious. He is beyond our understanding. So we have to take it on faith, right? I heard it said once that faith is like a muscle. The more you use it, the stronger your faith becomes. So our pithy human brains could never understand the mind of God. We must blindly trust in that God. And then in the next breath, they'll talk about how the proof is all around us. All you have to do is look. Everything from the rainbow to the time that I prayed for Grandma when she had cancer, and her cancer suddenly went into remission, you know, after 9 months of chemotherapy. But I was praying at the same time, and I know it was God. The genome. We see this from people like Dr. Stephen Meyer, who, by the way, is not a geneticist, but he talks about, you know, down to our DNA. If you look at our genetic code, there is proof that we are designed by a designer. And of course, I'm thinking to myself, hang on just a second. What you're telling me is that God hid his design in a way where humankind would not be able to see it until we had developed the technology to decode the genome. I mean, that just seems sadistic. I'm reminded of that section about the Babel fish from Douglas Adams and The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And he was talking about, you know, the Babel fish, the oddest thing in the universe. And he had this sort of jab at the intelligent designer in this line. He said, "Now it is such a bizarrely improbable coincidence that anything so mind-bogglingly useful could have evolved purely by chance, that some thinkers have chosen it to see as a final and clinching proof of the non-existence of God." The argument goes something like this. "I refuse to prove that I exist," says God, "for proof denies faith, and without faith I am nothing." "But," says man, "the Babel fish is a dead giveaway, isn't it? It could not have evolved by chance. It proves you exist, and therefore, by your own arguments, you don't. QED. Oh dear, says God, I hadn't thought of that, and promptly vanishes in a puff of logic. And it's a great point. Is it faith, or is it proven? Do we just believe, or do we get to know for sure? Put 50 apologists in a room and ask that question and just watch them go at each other.
My name is Margaret Downey. I'm the founder and president of the Free Thought Society. I'm most weary of religious people saying, God willing, or thank God I'm alive, or praise the Lord, and God must have a plan. I hear these statements most often after a disaster has struck, as if situations of death, hardships, and devastation is proof that a God really does exist. The truth is that there is no God, and a disaster is an example of the fallacy of a God belief. Atheists view the world as a natural place, so disasters, death, and hardships are completely expected and understandable. There is no God judging who deserves to live or die. There is no God making up challenging situations. There is no God punishing or rewarding people. There are only natural circumstances, human vulnerability, and human solutions. So when a disaster strikes, atheists should encourage a natural view of life in language and action. Challenge those God statements by using words of reality and your human ability to help. Encourage people to thank the firefighters, police officers, volunteers, and medical professionals who jump into action when disasters happen. They were not sent by God. They are doing the work that needs to be done, not God. Praise science as often as possible and remind the religious community that everything can be explained if they look at the world through the lens of nature. Together, we can make the world a better place without a God belief.
Guy I'm friends with on Twitter, his name is Bob Ingersoll, he posted this chart and I bookmarked it. And it was kind of a message to the apologist who are wanting to convince us that their God is real. I won't read the whole chart here, but I thought it was amusing. It says, I was a Christian, now I'm not. Do you feel the need to convert me back? Save everyone some time and read this first. Start here. First, convince me there is a God. Then there's only one God. Then yours is the correct God. And then that God is omnipotent and all-knowing. And then if that God is moral, and then does that God interact with the universe, with the earth, and with human beings? And only after that can we get on with the rest of the specifics about your God. Here's what has not worked so far. Quoting from your God's good book. My father used to do this all the time when we had these discussions before I sort of shut them down. He would always quote the Bible. And I would say, well, how do you know that's accurate or true? Where did it come from? And his response would be to quote more Bible. It's like quoting the Quran to prove the Quran. It's like quoting a Marvel comic book to prove the Marvel universe. Telling me that I actually do believe in God, but I'm in denial. I have repressed it. You know, if you're being honest with yourself, Seth, deep down, you know there is a God. You're just in rebellion. And some others on his chart, you know, look at all the miracles, personal experience. It happened to me under my skin, and you can't tell me that that wasn't real. And they might invoke the laws of physics or the beauty of nature or some coincidence. You know, I had this serendipitous moment where I bumped into a person I hadn't seen in 20 years. God must have brought us together. And of course, this speaks to how we are pattern-seeking animals. We're always looking for patterns and meaning underneath everything else. And finally, you know what? You're a sinner, and you're going straight to hell. How many times have you and I engaged a believer, and we challenge them on their truth claims, and at the end of the conversation, they just say, "You'll just see one day, mister, when you die, and you go up and you stand before the throne of judgment, and God sends you on that slippery slide straight down into the fiery inferno where you will roast and scream and cry and burn and burn and burn forever. You will just see." Like it is the coup de grace in an argument. Just wait till you die is their method for proving their particular truth claim, right? Well, I don't have the data. Let's threaten them. Who was that comedian who said it so well? He said, "Threatening an atheist with hell, it's like a hippie threatening to punch you in your aura." I just thought that was awesome. Let's talk to an ex-Scientologist, and there's a batshit cult. Chris Shelton extricated himself from Scientology, and now he is an online activist. I knew he'd have an apologetics argument, maybe a quirky one related to Scientology. Chris Shelton, good to have you. How you doing?
Hey, I'm good, Seth. How are you, man?
I think about you every time I see like the Leah Remini special. They just released the Scientology documentary series from her on Netflix. And, you know, I follow Tony Ortega's work. And, you know, you were hardcore Scientology, right?
Yes, I was. I was as hardcore as you can get.
Scientology, I know it's got its apologists and people are always tapping you on the shoulder.
Very much so, yes.
And what are you hearing out there?
Well, here's the thing that I find most annoying, or one of the things I find most annoying from the apologia corner. And that actually comes out of the religious scholars. You know, it's easy to find people on social media to, you know, have some inflammatory conversation, quote unquote, with. But when academic grade scholars, we're talking about sociologists, religious scholars, are publishing social science articles written in full academia discussing the fact that apostates, people who are in these groups, who come out of them, who escape from them, should not be listened to, should not be given the time of day by academics, because they are seen as having an axe to grind against their former groups. And, of course, there are a number, a host of logical fallacies connected with this argument. But it is made in very serious terms. An example is J. Gordon Melton, who is a particular religious scholar who operated out of the University of Santa Barbara, who talked about Scientology and apologized for and basically regurgitated Scientology's promotional materials in his academic papers. And I wish this was only a one-off, but I ended up actually doing an entire deconstruction of a whole book of academic-grade essays and articles written by scholars from around the world, specifically on the topic of Scientology. And I think there were a total, I didn't look, but I think it was 20, 23 or something chapters in this book. Every one except one of those chapters was a Scientology promotional piece in academic language. And I just could not believe that people who were college-educated, serious scholars, considered themselves people who really took this work seriously, could forward cult propaganda in such a blatant manner. It really took me by surprise.
There's a lot to unpack here. I'm going to try to hit several points. First of all, we've got the attack the messenger tactic, right? I mean, nobody criticizing us could ever do so legitimately. They must have an agenda.
Exactly.
And then there's the degree mongers. Now, I'm not trying to diminish the hard-won PhDs out there, but, you know, we find that there are a lot of people who try to insulate themselves from peer review, analysis, criticism, having to back up what they say by just throwing the credentials out. You know, Deepak Chopra has a PhD, you know, when he's talking about the quantum metaphysical material world that is not material, you know, he's out there in Wooville. He has a PhD. You know, we have to go a little deeper. What are the other experts saying about this expert? Has this sort of run the gauntlet? And so we see a lot of PhD types who are propped up because of their degrees by religions and cults, Scientology, no exception.
That's exactly right. And just because people might find this interesting, this has actually led to decades in the academic community of what are referred to as the cult wars, where academics are fighting academics over this very thing. So I certainly don't want to imply that all academics are like this. But unfortunately, in religious studies, it appears about a 50-50 split from what I've been able to see or expose so far. So this is a problem.
How did Scientology filter out information?
It's self-policing. They have a style of indoctrination that convinces people that there is information they can be exposed to which would be spiritually, mentally, psychologically damaging to them. Just the information. And once you can convince somebody that that's true, then it's just a matter of convincing them that this piece of information is one of those dangerous things that you must not look at or be exposed to because it will literally threaten your spiritual eternity.
We were talking on Twitter about this. I'm not really sure if I maybe misread his intention, but Neil deGrasse Tyson had said something about how one of the best ways to determine if you're in a cult is to ask somebody outside the cult, hey, am I in a cult? And I responded, this is a terrible way to disabuse someone. Pointing at someone in a cult and saying, you're in a cult is not really, that may not have been his larger point, but that's how I read it. The whole point of the cult is to establish a new normal and a distrust of the outside world.
Absolutely.
Scientology has an arsenal then of these, I don't know, experts. What would you call them? I mean, do they have like a, you know, a star chamber filled with people out defending the faith, or do they even give a shit at this measure?
No, they actually do. You've described the situation perfectly. They have a coterie of academics that they call upon, and that they have sort of fostered these relationships for a couple decades now. And they decided that academic scholarship was one of the public relations moves that they would make organizationally to try to gain credibility. Then there are certain academics who are basically academics for hire, or who are so fanatical about their views on religious freedom that those views eclipse the abuse that clearly goes on in these groups, and they end up being apologists for these groups because of their overly strong views about how everybody has the right to believe whatever they want, which in and of itself is true enough, but when you're using that right to excuse straight-up trauma and abuse, then we've lost the plot, and that's what's going on here.
It's also, I think, in some cases, an intimidation tactic. So I'm sitting here, I'm some schlub named Seth, and I walk into a room, and I'm like, okay, I don't buy it, like whatever your truth claim is. And then he goes to the wall and starts pointing at all these framed degrees. And in some cases, I am meant to feel inferior and stupid and undereducated and disqualified.
That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah, it can become a status thing for sure. And in fact, probably the key driver to Scientology paying for these papers or getting these papers written is that these serve as expert witnesses in court. And so this is one of the ways that we get Scientology and other destructive cults winning or getting cases dismissed out of hand in courts, is because these academics will go and carry water for them. So this is a big problem.
So they've weaponized the educational system. I mean, I hate to use the word education when it comes to a cult like Scientology, but you know what I'm trying to say.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely, I do. In fact, I can tell you now, getting my master's that I'm getting in psychology right now, there's no question you have to work hard to get these degrees, but there is no guarantee going through this process that you're going to come out the other side a good critical thinker. And that's unfortunate, but still a truism of our system. And that's what we really need to fix.
I'm reminded of something that Dr. Harriet Hall, the skeptoc, said once. She said, if you come across a position, go out and read all of the most credible disagreeing positions or criticisms about that claim. So if someone makes a claim, that is the beginning of your journey and not the end.
You got it.
I appreciate your work sort of exposing Scientology, and thanks for chiming in here on the show, man. It's always good to talk to you.
You bet. Thanks for the opportunity, Seth. Always good talking to you.
All right, next up, since we just heard from an ex-Scientologist, let's hear from an ex-Muslim.
Hi, I'm Mohammed Sayed, president of Ex-Muslims of North America. We're a nonprofit that aims to reduce discrimination faced by those who leave Islam, and we advocate for acceptance of religious dissent. Seth asked me to speak about some of the apologetics we encounter. One of the most amusing or annoying responses we get is straight up denial. It's not denial in the sense of denying why we hold the positions we hold, but rather that we are who we say we are. To put it in political terms, it's not simply ascribing ill intent to those on the opposite political side, Republican or Democrat, but denying that such an opposite side even exists. Imagine not encountering arguments that you consider incorrect or nonsensical even, but a denial of your existence or your position entirely. We often get responses like you were never a Muslim to begin with the implication that no one can actually leave Islam or view it as incorrect if they were ever Muslim to begin with. The follow-up thought process tends to be, why would we be doing what we do? Obviously, there must be some sort of massive financial incentive. We're being funded by some sort of shadowy cabal. It must be a government psyop, a Western government psyop of some form, or perhaps a Jewish conspiracy. Anti-Semitism, as you can guess, is quite pervasive. What kind of financial incentive would you have to offer for someone to stand up to a religion that will straight up kill you for disagreeing with it? And how many people will you have to offer that? There are millions upon millions of people leaving Islam. A more humorous side of the same phenomena is the reaction of Muslim family members when ex-Muslims come out of the closet, particularly so if we go public. On the one hand, we hear that there is no issue whatsoever, Islam is all about peace, and that we're making a mountain out of a molehill. While in the same breath, they express genuine fear for our safety and for our lives. In any case, we've made a great deal of progress in raising awareness. There's still quite a way to go. Here's to this next decade, moving many, many more Muslims past the stage of denial.
More bad apologetics coming up. Matt Dillahunty on tap. I've got Thomas Smith and Andrew Torres from the Opening Arguments podcast. Tracy Harris, lots of good stuff in just a second. Matt Dillahunty. I do not know how many debates he's done. I don't know how many apologists he has engaged, but it has been a lot. And I knew he'd have something good for us. And so, you know, here we go. Which one do you want to talk about?
So today, it's so funny because when we first talked about doing this, I was like, oh my gosh, which argument should I go with? And I've heard everything over and over. But I think I want to talk about something that happened again today for the umpteenth time, and that is non-arguments. Today I was threatened. I was, first of all, I was called Satan and I was threatened with hell by the same person. And I'm like, hang on, is hell really a threat for Satan? But in the course of this quick back and forth on Twitter, I was like, how deluded do you have to be to threaten people with something that you can't provide evidence for? And the response came back, you have to go beyond evidence. And I would have been a spit take if I'd have been drinking anything. This, you have to go beyond evidence. What is there beyond evidence? What is there but evidence? I was like, could you at least present some evidence? And then maybe later, once we get the evidence, we could then go beyond evidence. And to that, it was, well, you'll find out. And it was just, it was the same thing of, oh, well, you're going to find out when you're dead. Of all the things that people could use to try to prop up their belief or what they're doing, I'm extremely confused when their response is an admission that they don't have arguments, that they don't have evidence, but they have something better.
I'm interested in the conversation-stopping utility of that, right? It's designed just to shut you down. Well, you just wait. But I'm also interested in this sort of gleeful dancing on your grave kind of attitude by people who are supposed to be demonstrating the love of Jesus Christ.
They bought into a notion that this world is broken, only God can fix it. This must be true. And so anyone who is in opposition to them must be of Satan. They must be deluded, and God's going to take care of them soon. The difference here is that this comes not from serious apologists. Well, all right. I suppose some serious apologists have used versions of this. They just hide the stupidity a little bit better by saying, you know, I can't demonstrate this is true, but I think there are good reasons to believe that that's the case. And sometimes it gets to Pascal's wager, which is ironically the one argument from theists that I declared moratorium on probably 10, 12 years ago.
Now, for the few who don't know what Pascal's wager is, go ahead and explain it.
Blaise Pascal was a mathematician who essentially argued that between Christianity and atheism, you should believe Christianity because if you're wrong, you've lost nothing. And if you're right, you've gained everything. And if you're an atheist, you've lost everything by not believing in this. It's got a gazillion one problems, but at least that's an attempt to make a case. It's the ones that don't attempt that are just a threat. It's right up there with, I've got a girlfriend who goes to another school, and so you don't know her, but her dad works for the FBI, and he's going to come kick your dad's ass. That's kind of what that threat of hell feels like.
Back to Pascal's wager. Isn't it interesting that that's not really a declaration of true belief, right? I'm going to choose to declare a belief, but it has nothing to do with an organic belief, a deep-seated idea or belief within you, right?
Yeah, it's actually one of my favorite points. Blaise Pascal agreed with me that you cannot choose to believe. He actually addresses this in his writings about Pascal's wager. He makes the case and says, but belief is not subject to the will. You can't just say, well, I'm going to believe this. And so what Pascal goes on to advocate is fake it till you make it. He says you should pretend to believe and continue to do that until it makes you believe. He's actually advocating for self-deception and indoctrination because he knows you can't just choose to believe something is true. You have to be convinced. You can be convinced for good reasons or bad. And Pascal went with bad. He went with bad in his argument. And then in response to criticism of his argument, he went even worse, which was, you should pretend as if you believe, fake it till you make it, and you will then eventually be granted this belief by God or by indoctrination.
I was struck by this notion that we could fool God. Like before I had effectively self-deceived, right? If I'm declaring belief, am I not saying that an omniscient God couldn't tell the difference?
Yeah, it's one of the points that I made in the initial response was, do you think you can fool God? And so if you use Pascal's wager and you're just like, well, I'm going to go along with it, Pascal addressed this a little bit as well. I don't think Pascal thought you could deceive God, but he did have a slightly simplistic, he had a good view about belief, but he had a slightly simplistic view of enacting belief. His hope wasn't so much that you could fool God. His hope was that you would come to actually believe and that God would reward that.
You and I have had a conversation in the past, too, about how the claim itself is a fallacy, right? This notion that if I was wrong, and I'd lived an entire earthly life committed to a bad idea, well, at least I was safe from hell. It ignores this idea that I've wasted all of my decades here on earth.
Right. There's a number of problems with Pascal's wager. One is that it pits Christianity against atheism. It excludes all other religions. So it already begins with a dishonest dichotomy. But even in that dichotomy, the truth is, if I were to live a life according to Pascal's version of Christianity or whatever else, and it turned out that that was not true, I would have wasted the one and only life that I know I'm going to get. I traded it off in the hopes of getting some afterlife that I don't have evidence for that, by the way, isn't the only potential afterlife. I mean, what if you put Pascal's wager to work for everything, then you have to figure out, okay, do I first seek the best heaven or do I first avoid the worst hell? Or do I come up with which of these heaven or hells I think is most reasonable and kind of guess at it. And so it's all this stumbling around. It's human. It is stumbling around in the dark and it's not seeing that we don't have any reason to believe this. Pascal is the prime example. There's an old joke from a British comedian about a gentleman's talking to a priest about God And the priest says, well, you're like the blind man walking around in a dark room looking for a black cat that isn't there. And the guy says to the priest, and he's like, yes, and so are you, except you think you found it.
I think the two that you sort of proffered up here, you know, we've got Pascal's wager and this sort of hell threat. You just wait till you're dead. They tie in a little bit together. I don't think the Pascal wager is necessarily tied to an aversion to hell. I'd rather believe in God and be wrong doesn't necessarily require a hell. But certainly the hell threat is part of it, right? It's a fear-based reasoning.
Yeah, that's one of the interesting things about religion to me. And that is, it can be viewed in a number of different ways, fairly and honestly. You could say, ah, I'm not accepting Pascal's wager out of fear of hell. I'm accepting Pascal's wager out of a hope of a heaven, or out of a confidence that there's a God there that has the best interests of human beings at heart, or I just want to, you know, live in the best world, or everybody around me believes it, so there's social benefits to these things. There are many different ways that you can look at all of these. The problem is that you can't divorce any of them. If you say, ah, Pascal's wager isn't about a threat of hell, well, that's not really true. That's one prong of the dilemma. And it's the prong that comes out when everything else fails. If you can't convince people to lovingly accept God for their own good, then you threaten them.
You'll hear a lot about this kind of thing on Matt's Atheist Debates channel. And of course, he's co-host of the Atheist Experience. I knew you'd have some good stuff for us, my friend. And thanks for being a part of the discussion. Greatly appreciated.
Absolutely. Thanks so much.
Hey, I'm Jimmy Snow. I am a YouTuber and a professional pizza eater. So if I had to talk about my least favorite apologetic, I worry that I'm not really giving you the direct apologetic and I'm really giving you an apologetic method, but here we go anyway. The one that frustrates me the most is this sort of goalpost moving, oh, that thing which proved our past doctrines wrong actually has just proven it even more right. It's this sort of, there's an initial challenge to the introduction of new facts, an introduction to new science, and just a total denial that those things could be possible. And then when the facts become overwhelming, you have this adjustment to, oh, well, actually, that just proves that God's even more brilliant than I ever realized. You see it with both scientific and social issues. I mean, the most obvious one that comes to mind would be evolution and how the development of understanding the mechanisms of our body have gone from in many Christian circles, the ones who have at least caught up to current science, where it started out with a whole, nope, the earth is 6,000 years old. We're all descendants from Adam and Eve. Okay, sure, there's this commonality. Oh, well, yes, you see the commonality because God is in all things, so it just implies the same designer designed everything to, okay, well, there's this additional evidence, and let's talk about intelligent design and how evolution perhaps could have been the mechanism by which God did these things, but first it was microevolution, now it's macroevolution, and all along the way, these things that debunked their original doctrine, they just adjust for and go, oh, well, God is even more brilliant than we ever realized without ever actually demonstrating the God. So it's sort of a combination of goalpost moving and presupposition. We're starting with God's real, and so anything that you can demonstrate to be a fact, I can just adjust my line of reason. I can just adjust the explanations for at a whim. And I've seen people do it in real time. I've seen people, in fact, I've participated in the past in doing it in real time where it was, oh, you've challenged my thing. Oh, you know what? But that just means X, Y, and Z, where they don't actually care so much about the content of what they're saying, but they've learned these presentations of their apologetics that they can kind of copy and paste anything in, and it won't matter whether or not what they're saying is factual or not, because this method of engaging about the information is adequate to them to make them feel like, yeah, I definitely did enough here. I guess if I could add a second one, and I don't even know if this would be considered an apologetic or not. But I guess I would go with the Mormon default, which is when in doubt, when you are losing, when you you do not have the facts, when you are engaging in a conversation that you cannot be challenged on, just bear your testimony. And while I don't think it directly is an apologetic self, I've seen it used in the same place and in the same way as apologetics, which is why I think it's worth bringing up, that it is this sort of thing that if you're losing, you might still be able to win them over with the power of your confidence. And if you don't win them over these people, you get to use this story to win other people over and perpetuate the faith of others. And this is how it goes. They're losing their conversation, their points, they're losing the facts, and they just go, listen, I know the church is true. I know Joseph Smith was a prophet. And they start speaking in no's because they don't know how to use the word no. Belief with confidence is not knowledge. And there is the fact that they are taught when you have been shown not to know things, just to believe, to start reciting I know phrases. It's a thought-stopping technique. And so my frustration with apologetics isn't so much that I worry that they are losing or that they are winning over the minds of actually skeptical people. More so it is that they have intercepted people prior to them becoming adequately skeptical and do, in some cases, a very good job at preventing that eventual skepticism. That is what I would say in my few minutes here. Those are the examples of the most frustrating uses of apologetics, and hopefully I've somewhat answered the question. Again, I'm Jimmy Snow, and let's be clear, the sauce in the pizza is an important component. And so any of these places you go to that are like, hey, we got the best pizza, and they really don't give you enough sauce, that's wrong. And I hope that's the most important thing you take out of what I say here.
Hello, this is Thomas Smith and Andrew Torres of the Opening Arguments podcast. How's it going, Andrew?
I'm fantastic, Thomas. How are you?
I'm doing great, although I suppose I may be doing less great when we talk about obnoxious arguments in favor of God. I gotta say, for me, what always gets me, there's so much, but one that always gets me is this idea of, well, if there's no God, then anything goes morality-wise, and what's to stop anyone from, you know, doing horrible things and et cetera, et cetera. And it's funny, I don't know if I have the response that will appeal to the most people, perhaps, but my thought is always like, yeah, anything does go, actually. Look throughout human history, and all it is a horror show of terrible things happening to people. It's awful. And that sucks. People try to do a different argument because they're worried about losing people, you know. But in my mind, as an atheist, I'm sitting here saying, yes, anything does tend to go. And if we want to craft a more moral society, it's actually on us. And it might be a more difficult position to take, but I feel like we have to all put on our big boy pants and figure out how to make things more just in society. We can't rely on some fake story to motivate everybody that they're going to be punished in the afterlife. Guess what? Like, the majority of people have been religious, and that hasn't stopped people from being awful.
And let me jump off of that. Let me define out the argument in a syllogism form and then talk about how I immediately undertake the opposite strategy, and we can kind of go from there. All right, so I understand the argument, this kind of being like the argument from moral facts, and it goes something like this. If objective moral facts exist, then an objective moral lawgiver must exist to establish those facts, right? That's premise one. Premise two, objective moral facts exist. Therefore, the conclusion, an objective moral lawgiver exists. And I hear you disputing premise two, which I think is a far more robust position than Christians ever give when they're sort of uttering this argument, right? Because then they'll just be like, oh, well, are you in favor of slaughtering puppies for fun, or, you know what, right? But the answer to that, right? The answer to any of those questions could be, no, I'm not. That could still not be an objective moral fact in the philosophical sense, right? Like intuitionism could be true, right? That all of our moral precepts are just manifestations of our subjective intuitions. And you will have proved nothing more than humans tend to think that torturing puppies is bad, which that also happens
yes,
to be true.
My position is that morality is something that is an evolved trait that we have, and we all tend to have similar instincts, but we don't agree entirely. And in fact, there are disagreements that I don't think you can resolve by saying, there is no ultimate source that you point to. And the Bible is certainly not helpful along those lines.
Obviously, no disagreement there. I want to say this. I think you can concede that there are objective moral facts in the philosophical sense.
If you want to.
And dispute premise one, and dispute that sort of in two ways, right? So affirmatively, I would say, in order for premise one to be plausible, the Christian apologist has to answer the Euthyphro dilemma. And they can't. Yeah. Like, they suck at this. And by the way, don't fall into their trap, right? Like, so the way in which you fall into their trap is by saying, oh, just repeating the Euthyphro dilemma and saying, like, so are God's commands moral because they're God's commands, at which point they're arbitrary, or are they moral because God is applying some pre-existing moral code, at which point you don't need God? Mm-hmm. Because they will come back and they will say the only innovation in theological apologetics in 2,500 years has been to say, oh, no, we're not saying that they're moral because they're God's commands. We're saying they're moral because they're consistent with his nature. So build that into your question, right, on Euthyphro. Be like, all right, so is God's nature moral because it's God's nature, right? Because all it does is shift the level of resolution up one layer, right? Like, so say, all right, is God's character moral because he's God, at which point that's arbitrary, not objective, or is God's character moral because it is in pre-existing alignment with independently good moral duties, right? Like, for example, they will say, God can't lie. That's cool. Why is lying an immoral thing? At every level, they're stuck with either saying, yeah, well, no, if we had a trickster God, then lying would be a moral imperative, or with saying, as they always will fall into, yeah, they're independent things that we can derive as sort of general moral principles, and I want to ascribe them to my God. Cool, that's not an argument for your God.
I hear you. I think I'm thinking of this along more of a psychological argument. I think what people are seeking when they make this argument, they are worried about people doing bad things. You know, people in general, for the most part, they want to be good, I think, and they also want other people. They're worried about other people being good. And they're worried that if there is no ultimate lawgiver, there's nobody in the afterlife who's going to punish you if you're bad. What's to stop somebody, especially in a moment where no one's watching? What's to stop somebody from doing the wrong thing? I'll fully acknowledge that this is not an answer that's the happiest answer. My answer is nothing. If truly no one is going to see and you're not going to be caught and you're not going to be punished by people on earth, unfortunately, nothing stops you. But what we can acknowledge is that we build societies, we build systems of law. That's a lot of what our show is about. And opening arguments, by the way, find podcast stores everywhere. We do that because we all kind of want to be, I think for the most part, we want to live in a society with rules where people are going to do the right thing. We want to inspire that behavior, and we want to inspire that behavior in other people. And I see it in my kids every day. Like, they get it on some level. They want fairness. They want those things. And I would just say it's up to us. You know, for me, it's not a pleasant thing to know that, you know, someone like Pol Pot right now isn't being punished in hell or something. But also, how weird of a system would that even be? Where a God made somebody in a society where people do horrible things to each other. And then that God, who is all-knowing, by the way, and was in control of this whole thing, also wants to punish them for getting it wrong forever. That doesn't sound good either. I mean, who would possibly deserve an eternity of punishment? Nobody would. Nobody, no human could possibly ever deserve an eternity of punishment. So I think the whole thing collapses.
I think of kind of three things that I want to amplify. The first is, I'm not sure I agree with you on the motivation of apologists who make this argument. I think apologists know they're defending a system of nonsense, right? They're defending an imaginary man in the sky. And so they have a lot of these techniques like, oh yeah, well, explain how, you know, the lesser ankle joint of the spotted weasel frog evolved.
I don't think that's who I'm talking about. Just clarify, that's not who I'm talking about. I think we're talking to two different audiences. I just mean your everyday Christian you talk to, for example.
I certainly agree that if you are talking, but I think that the argument takes a different form when you're talking to a friend in good faith versus you're talking to a Frank Turek type who's just a lying sack of garbage, right? And there, what they're taking advantage of is they're subtly putting the burden of proof on you. Oh, you're an atheist? Okay. Articulate for me a coherent theory of moral realism in 8 seconds, right? And like, that's what the question is. And you know what? Like, people aren't good at that because most people don't have an undergraduate degree in philosophy. And like, even if you do, most people aren't good at communicating that in a short period of time. So I think this is all meant to like subtly shift the burden of proof and also to sort of play on these tropes. Second, I love what you said. It also, I think, conflates the idea of motivation and enforcement, right? Mm. Because it all ultimately comes down to, you could articulate a fully secular accounting of objective moral facts, and inevitably, I promise you, 100 times out of 100, you'll get the like, well, yeah, but if there isn't a God to punish you for violating it, why should you, right? And the answer to that is a Kantian answer, right? The answer to that is, like, I know, as a matter of pure mathematics, right? So therefore, I can know it objectively, what Kant says a priori, as a synthetic a priori, that 7 + 5 = 12, right? I don't have to count up 7 items and 5.
But who's going to punish me if I say it's 13?
But here's the thing. That's right. And so when I'm filling out my taxes, suppose I'm adding up my sources of income.
The IRS
and I'm
will
saying,
punish you.
Right. 7,000 plus 5,000. I then face the choice. If I write 13,000 or 11,000 or whatever, I then know that I'm violating my moral code. Might I do it anyway? Sure. But that problem is non-unique as between the religious and the irreligious. Christians violate their legal code, their moral
IRS
codes all
anybody,
the time.
Yeah.
Well, the IRS, like, you know.
Well, they've solved that. They don't have to, you know, file any significant reporting if they own a church, you know, what they're doing.
Well,
with
that's
their money,
true. So. But yeah, like my favorite fact is that the highest sales, not just per capita, but the highest sales of Spectravision, right? The in-hotel porn is in Utah, right? Like, because even they know when nobody's watching, it's all right, well, you know, time to put on the boobies, right? So that question of enforcement is non-unique, whether you're religious or irreligious. And then the third point that I truly love for sort of going back on the offense is, at what point does the Christian system of morality make the slightest bit of sense, right? Like, you can do the Adolf Hitler, I'm in a bunker, I say a tiny little prayer, oh, sorry about all the Jews things, God, like, and then poof, eternity in heaven versus Gandhi, like, oh, I'm sorry. And you could ask, like, I get that we could, let's make Gandhi suffer in hell for 1 trillion years. But like, after 1 trillion years, is it okay to let, nope. Come on. Like, this is an insane system that lacks any sense of proportionality. And the only way that Christian apologists can make that make sense is by coming up with some like rescue apologetic of like, ah, but you see, the offense is against God and you've offended an infinite being and therefore it's an infinite offense in response. at which point it's like, so you're telling me that making God sad is infinitely harmful, but killing 6 million actual humans is something that, you know, you can get away with.
Yeah, that strikes me as the opposite of true. If I tell me if the law backs me up, but if I steal $1 from a homeless person, that seems way more offensive than stealing $1 from Jeff Bezos.
Yeah, so you're right there. The way in which an apologist, the way in which Frank Turek would come back to you would be like, well, you see, if I disobey, like, my wife, I might have to sleep on the sofa. If I disobeyed the mayor, I might have to move town. But if I disobeyed the king, you know, he could have me executed. And they use these kinds of examples, not understanding that unlike their moral code, we've changed in the past 1,000 years.
Well, I'm sure we've taken too much of Seth's time already, but Seth, thank you for the invitation to do this. We're going to go argue with each other and have more conversations about this for another 90 minutes, but we'll spare you all. But thanks so much for having us on.
Thanks, Seth. We love you.
Before I get to the clip from Tracy Harris, and I just reached out to her on a whim. I know she's kind of been out of the counter-apologetics game for a while. She's doing her own thing. But, you know, she had had so many of these conversations. She's so freaking smart. I've had her on the show just recently. I said, would you contribute something? And she was kind enough to do that. So I'll play that here in just a second. But I was thinking about another. It's not really an argument. It's really more of a tactic. When I'm dealing with religious people, they look at me and say, you're just arrogant, or atheists are arrogant. The atheism position is one of arrogance. And this is designed as a conversation stopper. It has nothing to do with the ideas being presented. It's really an attack on your person. You're just arrogant, right? How dare you? And yet, when I look back at myself when I was a believer, I mean, what position could be more arrogant than the one of the fundamentalist Christian? I look at myself when I was in my 20s, and I was convinced that God had conjured into existence hundreds upon hundreds of billions of galaxies. And then he created this little planet over here, this rock. And this rock was the center of everything, not the literal center of the universe, but the center of God's attention, the center of his focus. We just assumed everything else in the universe was all lifeless and void and filler, and it was like the earth. That's what God's interested in, and then he created us, the most important beings in the universe that were not God. In fact, we were adopted, so we're part of God's family. And God is making a place for his children right now. In fact, we would talk about heaven like it's under construction, like it's a work in progress. God is every day adding to heaven, making it grander, you know, the streets of gold and the pearly gates and the mansions and the cities reaching up to the sky. And who knows what we thought heaven was. And it's being prepared. God is preparing a place for us. And so here on this earth, we are earning our heavenly reward by going on a divine quest. We have been sent out on a crusade for our king, the most important king in the universe, to go out and do his will, to be rewarded with an eternity of joy and bliss and crowns and jewels and whatever. Okay? Essentially, our position was, except for God, we were the most important things in the universe. I mean, granted, there's a lot of baggage there. You know, you're born unworthy and you have sin and you deserve hell. But once you are redeemed, I mean, now you're in. You are royalty. You're part of the royal family. You are special. And so I find it hugely ironic when somebody who holds that position and opinion and attitude about themselves then looks at us and says, you're just arrogant. You know what? Only arrogance would deny the existence of a God. And I'm like, how does that even work out? Now that I am no longer a believer, I am pretty much convinced that the universe doesn't care whether I live or die. The laws of nature are not interested in me. They certainly don't bend to my will or my prayers. I don't see a sense of divine destiny. I know that once I am dead, I will be reintegrated back into the universe and long forgotten. I am not the center of all things. How is that a position of arrogance? I mean, if you look at it objectively, it's the person who says, I'm special enough for God to jump through all these hoops for me and make a mansion for me and give me a sense of divine destiny and adopt me into the royal family. That's a position of arrogance. Hashtag irony. Here's another one that I have seen out there. I'm just talking. This is not really an argument. It's more of, I think, a wish that people have. And I kind of understand it. But I have been speaking about, you know, living in a world that doesn't really care if we exist. And it's a temporary life. And it is not a fair life. And there is no cosmic justice. And this really bothers some people because they see awful people getting away with it, and they take some comfort in the notion that there is a judgment seat. Right? There is some sort of cosmic judge that will one day hold them accountable for their actions. And I'm not necessarily talking about, you know, being born with a sin nature, being judged for being a sinner, but they hold on to this notion that, hey, whatever goes around comes around. It's kind of a play on karma, right? This cosmic justice. So, hey, you know, they may not have been caught in this life, or they may not have faced the consequences on this planet, but once they died, they finally got what was coming to them. And the idea that there may not be this sort of cosmic equilibrium, the gavel pounded by some just being out there somewhere, you know, that really bothers them. And I understand why. We moral creatures, we just hate to see awful people getting away with it, even though it happens all the time every day. You know, they get off scot-free. Meanwhile, wonderful good people get kicked in the teeth every 5 seconds. It's hard to watch. Life can be terribly unfair and unjust in that way. But this sort of holding on to the idea of a cosmic overseer, a God, do you really want to live in a world where so-and-so gets away with it? That's just a wish. It's not even an apologetic, even though it's sometimes used like one. It's a little bit like, don't you want to go on or live on after this life? You know, how can you not have a notion of heaven, life 2.0, an afterlife continuing on? Do you really want to embrace this notion that right here, right now is it and there's nothing after? This for them, I think, constitutes a reason for belief, but it's nothing more than a wish, right? It's nothing more than a wish. But as we've seen, wish thinking, it's rampant in religions far and wide all around the world. Tracy Harris, she's a friend, and she's somebody who spent a lot of time, a great many years during her tenure as co-host of The Atheist Experience. And I know she's been doing other things recently, but I just thought she'd be good for the show. In fact, I thought she'd be perfect. And she recorded, I think, 15, 20 minutes of commentary. And we will hear Tracy Harris right after this. Don't forget, you can get this broadcast early, and you can get it commercial-free. I so appreciate my sponsors, and I love my patrons, and I'm so thankful for your support at patreon.com/SethAndrews. If you are a longtime fan of The Atheist Experience, or maybe you just found out about The Atheist Experience and you were going back through the archive, through past episodes, there is no doubt you have stumbled across Tracy Harris. She was a co-host for that broadcast for a lot of years and always had some unique and really thoughtful insights. I just knew she'd have some great commentary for this broadcast. She was kind enough to participate, and I'm hugely thankful. Tracy Harris.
Seth reached out to me with the understanding that I'm not that involved in the atheist community anymore, but he asked if I'd like to participate in this podcast that dealt with memorable apologetics, I suppose. And I offered that what I could do was something I'd noticed recently, which was during all of this weird last, I guess, presidential administration cycle, and with the elections and all of the absolute wildness that we've seen going on socially, I've noticed a lot of parallels between what I'm seeing outside of religion in politics that reminds me so much of what I saw when I was involved in dealing with religious people as part of atheist activism. One of the things that stood out to me was this apologetic that they were using that if Trump lost an election, it had to be fraudulent. This reminded me so much of God can't be evil. So everything God does must be good. So their apologetic seemed to be if Trump loses an election, then it was fraudulent. And it raised the question, is it fraudulent because he lost? Or do you really believe that he lost because of fraud? And I think there were probably a little of both in those camps, but ultimately it seemed like what they were basically saying is, I just cannot believe that Trump could legitimately lose an election. So if he lost, it had to be fraudulent. in the same way, if God did it, it must be good. Another apologetic parallel that I've noticed is the idea that anyone who does not support Trump has an anti-Trump bias. And they've even come up with this weird label, the Trump derangement syndrome, where they're saying that it can't be the case that you have a legitimate complaint about this president. You just hate him. That's all it is. You've just got this weird, irrational bias and hatred toward this president. You don't legitimately have issues with what he's trying to do. Everything he's trying to do is always great. And I saw this a lot when I was working in the atheist community, where it was, you know, atheists hate God. It can't be that you legitimately don't believe a God exists, that you've actually looked at the evidence and concluded that there is no God. It must be that you have some bizarro bias. There's something wrong with you, or you've got some past trauma, or you had a bad experience. And so whatever it is, it's just not that you don't really believe. And in the same way, if you really didn't have this bias about Donald Trump, you would support Trump. There's also been a ton talked about this whataboutism, right? So you talk about a complaint about Trump, and then the response is, well, what about this other thing? And generally, the parallels are not all that parallel, but the point is, the discussion really isn't about a past president or a past policy. It's about a policy happening now and something that's going on right now. The question isn't, has anyone else ever done it? The question is this a good thing to do? And should we still be doing it going forward, or doing it to the extremes in many cases that the Trump administration was carrying certain things to? So, for example, we have really poor immigration policy in this country, and we've never done really well with immigration. But there were new levels of abusiveness and damage that was done during the Trump administration that we had not seen in prior administrations, at least not in recent years. And so when people would bring it up, the response would be, you know, well, they separated families with past administrations. It's like, yes, but they didn't do it to the same degree. It wasn't a zero tolerance policy. And besides, we're not talking about a past administration. We're talking about, do you support this right now? In the atheist community, when I was doing work there, the ways that I would see this come up had to do with when atheism would talk about problems with religion, that, you know, issues that were inherent with, like, for example, religious hierarchical structures or anything like that. They would always get the rebuttal, well, atheism is a religion, or atheism is just like a religion, or it's you treat your atheism like a religion. So instead of addressing the issues that were going on with the religious structures, they were more interested in trying to turn it around and basically say, you're doing the same thing. And it was the same with faith. So they talk about faith as sort of this unique thing that they have. You know, I have this faith, you don't have this faith. But the moment you start to attack faith as belief without legitimate foundation, you get a response that, well, as an atheist, you have faith in things as well. You have faith in things like science. So there was also this whataboutism that I saw during my time in the atheist community as an activist. And talking about faith in science, or the accusation of faith in science, kind of segues nicely into the science denialism, which is also happening. And I think that we've always known that this happens to some degree in politics, because we have political agendas that conflict with science. And a lot of times what we don't see is an honest conversation where people are saying, look, we have these competing interests and we understand that the science indicates XYZ, but we also have these other things we have to consider. And so while we want to take the scientific opinion into account, we don't necessarily discount everything else. We just sort of have to take that into consideration. What we normally get is science denialism. So people who don't want to admit that climate change is real because it impacts policies that impact businesses that some people don't want to deal with. So instead of saying, you know, we have costs that will rise if we have to accommodate these new restrictions, and so we're opposed to the restrictions, what we get is the science is bogus, which is not correct. And this reminded me of issues with evolution, obviously, and anything to do with the age of the Earth always is attacked by especially young Earth creationists. In the current climate, though, where I saw this was with dialogue around COVID. COVID was inherently damaging to our economy. Because the economy was a strong suit for Trump, a lot of his supporters didn't want to acknowledge that anything that could do damage to the economy was legitimate. So their push was to ignore COVID, to pretend it didn't exist, or to pretend that it wasn't as bad as it was. They would often call it a hoax. And when they would acknowledge that it was real, they would say it's not as bad as how it's being sold. They would ignore overflowing hospitals, medical workers getting on television and pleading with people to follow mask protocols and social distancing. They would thumb their noses at these mitigation policies because they said they weren't necessary, they didn't work. They ignored the expert opinion, the medical community. They also attacked the death rates and said that they were inflated. And again, the idea was there was this mass conspiracy in which the medical community now was all biased against Trump in much the same way that science was, you know, always in a conspiracy against God when I was involved in discussing these issues with young Earth creationists. So they were basically willing to kill 500,000 people just to keep the economy rolling. Also, like young Earth creationists, they would find fringe scientists and unqualified scientists. So you saw a lot of the arguments from authority where someone was credentialed but not in the way that they needed to be making expert judgments about the current pandemic. And they did the same thing with media. So in the same way that they undercut legitimate science and put out illegitimate scientists or scientists that were not properly qualified in the fields required, they did the same thing with media. They started this whole campaign with mainstream media and undermining media outlets like New York Times and Washington Post that have been around for ages, that were well-established models of journalism. I'm not saying that they never made mistakes or never had to issue a retraction, but at the same time, they were imminently better sources of information than a YouTube channel or some random blog post. But inevitably, you would get into some sort of an engagement with someone and you would post this well-researched article with all these sources that were speaking in an educated way about different areas of political concern. And then someone would say, yes, but look at this YouTube video. So they were throwing aside legitimate journalistic outlets in favor of these weird third-party outlets that don't have robust fact-check departments, that don't have the same level of contacts in Washington, that don't have the same resources in any way whatsoever to accomplish the reporting that's required at the level of quality that these other outlets would be. And this was similar to how creationists created their own scientific journals and their own colleges and universities so that you could go and get a degree and you could, if you couldn't get published in legitimate scientific journals, you could just publish in these journals. And in the end, it was just a method of trying to set up their sources as being as valid as legitimate expert sources. One thing that was particularly disturbing was all of the claims of election fraud that dealt with specific states. So there was this idea of the Gish Gallop where you just simply throw a bunch of spaghetti at the wall and hope that something sticks. And even in this case, with so much spaghetti thrown at the wall, with all of these conservative states and conservative courts and even judges that Trump himself had appointed with Mitch McConnell, we saw again and again loss after loss after loss because there were no legitimate complaints. There was nothing that would overturn that election. There was a mountain of evidence that the elections were secure. Georgia got up every day and did a press briefing to talk about the tallies and where they were at and if there were any corrections that needed to be made and gave full transparency into why they needed to make corrections on their daily tallies. They would talk about which results had just come in and how that was going to change the counts. And they did everything they could to try and be transparent and to be forthcoming with their information. And in the end, we still saw this phone call where Donald Trump was still touting all of these conspiracy theories and the Georgia officials were saying, this is just not correct. This is just incorrect data, incorrect information. This did not happen or this did not happen that way. And Trump was impervious to the evidence. And so his supporters became impervious to the evidence. All they saw was so much spaghetti. There's so much spaghetti. Some of it, you know, this, all this, how can you ignore all the spaghetti on the wall? And in the meantime, while they're ignoring these detailed explanations of how the elections are working and how the elections are secure and all of the presentations to give them that information to help them feel confident in these final counts, they still preferred to believe conspiracy theories. Literally, they would say, but there's all these affidavits, without really even knowing, you know, who were behind these affidavits. What were they claiming? You know, like Trump, were they claiming that they saw someone run a ballot three times? Because there was a legitimate reason for why you would run a ballot three times that was explained by the Georgia election officials. So it's not about how many claims there are. It's about the quality of the claim. But we saw this so much in the atheist community when we would talk to young earth creationists. And I guess the final thing that I noticed is this weird demand for civility from a group of people who are completely indecent. So in the same way that these creationists would talk about how everyone deserves to burn in hell forever, you deserve eternal torture because you are that horrible of a person, and yet if you tell them that you think their religion is untrue, they would say you're not respecting their beliefs. And this is very similar, and we're seeing this now. So for the last 4 years before this last election, all we heard was fuck your feelings and elections have consequences and, you know, just basically shoving their initiatives and their opinions and the fact that they had won the election down everybody's throat for, you know, 4 years, and anything they wanted to do, it didn't matter how racist, how sexist, how damaging to the country, how damaging to the environment, anything they wanted to do, they had carte blanche to just do it. Just go out there and just be as destructive and nasty and just horrible as they wanted to be. And yet if you pointed out, hey, that's racist, they would freak out and tell you that you were being completely offensive by calling them a racist and, you know, turn it around. Oh, you're the real racist because you're even talking about race and I don't even notice race. So, you know, and so you get this whole thing where they can be racist, but you can't point out they're racist. And religion had a lot of that as well, right? So they could be this obnoxious about other people and this offensive to other people. But if you pointed it out, you were the one that was being offensive because you weren't respecting their views. I'm pretty sure there's a whole lot of other parallels that I haven't really thought about or noticed, or maybe I have noticed and haven't mentioned. So I invite people to think about those parallels and kind of ponder in your own head what you're seeing as we go forward in the next 4 years that I'm sure will be interesting.
Thanks again to Tracy Harris and all of the activists who participated. I hope this two-part series has been useful for you, providing reasonable insight and some helpful tools in your discussions every single day. Thank you so much for listening. Be safe out there. I'll see you next time.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. For a complete archive of podcasts and videos, products like mugs and t-shirts featuring The Thinking Atheist logo, links to atheist pages and resources, and details on upcoming free thought events and conventions, log on to our website, thethinkingatheist.com.